ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Reducing speeds on unsealed and dirt roads. The federal government's proposal is getting support from road safety groups as regional road deaths rise. But others say it's a lazy alternative to repairing country roads and may have unintended consequences.
Yeah, we'd have to be loading at a different time, or even the trucks might have to travel with two people driving just so that they don't run out of driving hours, because if they run out of their work hours, they have to stop for 6 or 7 hours, and that's just an animal welfare issue.
That story shortly. And Halloween is here, and one iris nursery in regional Victoria says its black flowers are blooming at just the right time.
I've never seen such a dark flower in local nurseries or just in general. It's near black, and when it comes out to bloom, it's usually around Halloween, which I find really cool.
I'm Alex Barwick, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Aranda Country in Mbantua Alice Springs, bringing you stories from across regional and remote parts of the country. But first this evening, we head to Newcastle. A warning for our next story. We're going to be talking about mental health and suicide. A heartbroken father is calling for a Senate inquiry into doctor suicide deaths upon learning his son's death was not an isolated case. This comes amid rising concerns about workplace safety and roster demands being placed on junior staff, many who are working in regional Australia. Newcastle reporter Giselle Wakatama has the story. Giselle, thanks for speaking to Australia Wide.
Thanks, Alex.
Giselle, tell me about your investigation. What happened to David, this young doctor in Newcastle?
Well, David's story is being told really on the back of some action that was taken here in Newcastle at the John Hunter Hospital earlier this year. So in sort of January, February, concerns about rostering triggered a leaked email from the hospital, which compared junior doctors to marshmallows. So at that point, with articles written and with the people taking action, the ABC was contacted by dozens of people, including David's father, who had spent several years trying to work with health officials to try and make things better, rosters and workplace culture, etc., in the wake of his son's death in December 2020. So this is nearly 5 years on. He had hoped for things to improve, but said that really with the situation with what they were calling Marshmallowgate, he was worried that rostering was still an issue. Now, his son, in the months before he died, he felt that he'd suffered blowback, he called it, in relation to his workplace. He had blown the whistle. He'd raised concerns about patient care at a hospital here in Newcastle through what was a reporting system, which is mandatory when there are concerns. He felt he was targeted and had been on sick leave when he was called. Now, the very last phone call he took, here's a bit of what his dad had to say. This is the day he died by suicide. Here's David's father.
He was called because they wanted to organise when he's coming back to work. And he said, I need to talk to my doctor and I'll get back to you by 2 o'clock. Well, by 2 o'clock, he was dead. It was all just too much for him.
So that was David's father there talking last afternoon. And what made things worse for David's family, friends, etc., was that on that very afternoon, within hours of him dying, an email came through from the hospital here in the Hunter, New England region, an email saying that it would be taking steps to prevent any future inappropriate rostering. So adding to the heartache of the family, here's a bit of what David's father had to say.
And in fact, the afternoon that he died, later in the afternoon, he received an email to say that don't worry, there will be no more inappropriate rostering from the roster person at the hospital, but it was too late. He was already dead.
David's father there again, Alex.
What an utterly heartbreaking situation. Mm. You've actually looked deeper and you found that David's experience was not a one-off. What have you uncovered?
So I've worked over those months since February, I guess being contacted by various people, looking at David's situation, but also getting contacted about others. And so independently, I've worked to verify, on my own, I've verified 13 deaths by suicide of doctors and some of nurses, but this is focusing on doctors, mainly junior doctors. So utterly heartbreaking in several states and territories, but the bulk in New South Wales, 9 of those 13 in New South Wales, indeed 5 of those in the very region I sit, which is the Hunter New England region. So looking at those independently, sort of verifying, speaking to colleagues and family about what might be a common theme. And you did mention in your introduction, rostering. You know, people have sent me rosters where they've worked 12, 13 days straight. And, you know, there's no let up, or they've been, you know, on call for 72 hours straight. And so they're saying that many people are at breaking point. Indeed, David's dad calling for a Senate inquiry into these issues. And he's had the backing of, you know, the doctors union, Tom Morrison, who's from ASMOF, knew David. And he has backed this call, for the inquiry. Here's a bit of what Tom Morrison had to say.
It's an enormous privilege to do this work. However, it shouldn't cost you your life in order to perform it. This is not a phenomenon that occurs in other industries. Clearly, something is different here, and clearly we need to address it at its root cause. I think we are definitely at a tipping point. We're seeing a culmination of stories and stories about crisis and crisis of individual workforce, and especially the junior doctor workforce in New South Wales. I think if something doesn't change, the system will break.
So that's Tom Morrison from the doctors' union ASMOF, but we know it's not just isolated here.
Giselle, what are you hearing as part of this investigation in terms of the pressures that young doctors are under in all states and territories, particularly in the regions?
The pressures just seem to be enormous. Indeed, Professor Gordon Parker, who knew David, who actually treated David for a mood disorder, and he knows all too well about burnout. He set up, you know, the Black Dog Institute. And he's told me throughout this investigation, you know, one of his biggest concerns is he knows of physicians, you know, on the wards inserting catheters to avoid having to go to the toilet, because there's just not that time to have that break to even go to the toilet. So he's saying that just enormous, you know, it's just relentless, and that the hours are, you know, you might have 12 or 13 days straight, but often, you know, people are staying behind because the very nature of working a health profession is empathy and caring and seeing a patient through. And he just said that really that there is a broken system that needs to be rectified. And that's the general consensus, that an inquiry is needed into health services to work out just what is sustainable, what's tenable, and, you know, what's not going to cause distress for these people who've signed up to help others.
Has there been a response from either federal or state health ministers to this call for an inquiry?
Well, certainly both have responded. We spoke to, through statements, the federal health minister, Mark Butler, who says that there are processes in place to try and support and bolster, you know, workforces to reduce burnout, etc. He wouldn't respond directly to calls for the Senate inquiry, but he said that the government was driving national reform in this area, strengthening cultures and reducing burnout, particularly in these hospitals where it's just they're under the pump 24/7. The New South Wales Health Minister Ryan Park, he sort of reached out directly to doctors, saying, you know, they're owed. He said, we owe it to our doctors that in all stages of their careers, that they're in workplaces that value well-being, compassion and balance. And that's what we're told from people who've contacted us, that these workplaces are very different to that. And of course, there is fear of career damage should you go against the system and speak out.
And finally, have you had any response from hospitals there in the Hunter region?
In the Hunter region, they said obviously they've reached out to David's family both then and now. We've got so many files of paperwork and letters and responses and promises for change. But the fact is that David's father is speaking out because he feels that really nothing much has changed. The hospital says, you know, there are support mechanisms within their services now, and the doctors are valued, they can speak out, etc. But for David's father, he feels that just not enough has been done in this space.
Thanks, Giselle.
Thanks.
Newcastle-based reporter Giselle Wakatama with that story. And if this story has raised any issues for you, please contact Lifeline on 13 11 14.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
To Central Australia. Getting the birth control you want isn't always easy, particularly in remote parts of the country. Women in Alice Springs have told the ABC they face long wait times to access intrauterine devices, also known as IUDs, forcing them to consider travelling interstate for insertion and removal. Alice Springs reporter Elsie Lange has this story.
Almost every day for 3 months, following the insertion of an intrauterine device, or IUD, Emma Condliffe woke up in agony.
I was worried every day, and there were days when I was like, should I just go to emergency?
But Miss Condliffe wasn't able to get an appointment with a local specialist to assess what was wrong. Miss Condliffe is one of multiple women who spoke to the ABC about how hard it is to find a healthcare professional to insert and remove IUD contraceptives in Alice Springs. Here are the voices of other women who struggled too.
Probably the two biggest hassles that I found was access to women's health doctors. There just weren't enough in Alice Springs. There was only one that I was informed of that could actually do this procedure for me with a copper IUD. And unfortunately, she resigned in between my first appointment and my second appointment. With her gone, I was then having to wait for a specialist to come up from Adelaide. The other thing, though, was access to the actual device.
Trying to get it out was an absolute nightmare in town. Like, I had to wait for a doctor that had the training to be able to take it out. Yeah, persevered for 14 months and I finally found a doctor after lots of research and phone calls and failed appointments. It's quite disheartening, I suppose, that it's so hard to be able to get contraception in town and make choices, I suppose, for our own body.
Currently I have the Implanon in my arm and it expires soon, so I need to get in something different. And the IUD was proposed to me as a really good option. Got referred to the hospital. I've been on the wait list since August, projected to be seen in February.
Those are just some of the voices of women who have struggled to get IUDs in Alice Springs. IUDs are small, plastic, T-shaped birth control devices inserted into the uterus. The long-acting reversible procedure is considered one of the most effective forms of contraception and, in the long run, cheaper than alternative options. There are several types of IUDs, including copper, which lasts about 10 years depending on the type, and hormonal, which include the Mirena and lasts 8 years, and Kylena, which lasts 5 years. They can be inserted by GPs, gynecologists, and family planning doctors, but in Alice Springs, there aren't enough local trained professionals to do so. Miss Condliffe, who is a nurse and midwife, said she thought something must be wrong after her IUD was inserted.
You know, me and my partner were worried. We thought maybe it's in the wrong place, like, we don't really know. My GP could only check like one way, she couldn't check the other way, she couldn't do an ultrasound because she wasn't a specialist. So she said, we'll book you in with the GP, the special GP that comes to town every 2 months. So I waited 2 months in pain. This GP cancelled her visit so that I couldn't get that appointment. And yeah, I'd never heard from the hospital this whole time. Thankfully, the pain resolved on its own.
And while Miss Condliffe is glad to have an IUD now, she said a lack of local specialist support made the experience difficult. A spokesperson from NT Health said the wait time to get an IUD inserted or removed at Alice Springs Hospital is dependent on individual patient conditions. For example, postpartum patients might get an appointment straight away, while those who have been referred through primary health care can wait up to 3 months. Multiple women have told the ABC they waited much longer than that. Miss Condliffe said the pain as her GP attempted the insertion was excruciating, and the only relief on offer was paracetamol and ibuprofen. She was then initially referred to Alice Springs Hospital, where patients can be sedated or receive localised anaesthetic during insertion. But more than a year on, she's still waiting to be contacted. getting an IUD removed by a specialist can be difficult too.
I was sort of coming up to a point where I was looking to get my IUD removed. I'd had it inserted in Sydney probably about 4 years ago. However, I couldn't find anywhere in town that would be able to do it in the time frame that I needed. The reason I wanted to get it removed was because I was sort of having a few complications, and it just felt like the time I needed to get it removed and start exploring other options.
That's Violet Kenner. She's 29 and was overdue for her IUD removal, but couldn't get an appointment in Alice Springs. She ended up getting the procedure done on a 4-day trip to Sydney.
Found like a private practice. Cost a little bit of money, but I kind of had to bite the bullet a little bit. I guess I would have liked more time to plan because I knew I was returning to Alice.
So what's the solution? Professor Danielle Mazza, Chair of General Practice at Monash University and expert in women's sexual and reproductive health, said IUD uptake in remote and regional Australia was slow.
We don't have enough providers of IUDs in Australia, particularly in primary care, where GPs aren't necessarily trained in how to put in an IUD, and they need a lot more education and also support after they are trained to both initiate that service provision and sustain it.
Professor Mazza co-authored research which helped inform the Commonwealth's multi-million dollar women's health package. It included a boost to Medicare funding for GPs to insert IUDs, as well as scholarships for remote GPs, nurses and midwives to get IUD insertion training. Since the scholarships became available on September 1st, Family Planning Welfare Association NT has experienced a big uptake in people wanting to get trained in IUD insertion, according to Chief Executive Nicole Stevens.
There's never enough trained doctors and health specialists for this particular service, hence why we have a comprehensive training course that will help train and retain health professionals to deliver this service in the NT.
Ms Condliffe wanted to share her story to improve access for women in Alice Springs.
Women's health is one of those things that falls through the cracks, and something like IUD and contraception, which is so important and really should be like a basic human right, is one of those things that are overlooked.
That report from Elsie Lange in Alice Springs. My name's Alex Barwick. You're listening to Australia Wide, bringing you stories from right around the country. And remember, you can always get in touch with the program via email, australiawide.radio@abc.net.au. Still to come on today's program, with road fatalities continuing to climb, often happening on outback roads, could the federal government's proposal to reduce speed limits save lives? Pastoralists in regional New South Wales say they're worried that it may well actually see roads go unfixed and could have unintended consequences around animal welfare and increased freight costs. And it's October 31, which means it's Halloween, and there's a nursery in regional Victoria growing irises. Black irises. They're in bloom, it seems, at just the right time.
I've never seen such a dark flower in local nurseries or just in general. It's near black, and when it comes out to bloom, it's usually around Halloween, which I find really cool.
That story shortly.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
We head to Broken Hill now. The number of road deaths has continued to rise in 2025 across rural and regional Australia. Communities are regularly devastated by accidents on unsealed and dirt roads. But what can be done about it? The federal government is proposing to reduce the default speed limit on unsigned roads outside of built-up areas. It would see speed limits lowered on both dirt and unsealed roads. But it's seen a mixed response. Broken Hill reporter Catherine Spackman has been looking into it. Catherine, good to talk to you this afternoon. First of all, talk us through what exactly the federal government has proposed and why.
So the federal government wants to reduce the speed limits on unsealed roads to 70 kilometres an hour and to sealed roads to 80 kilometres an hour. And they want to do it to reduce the number of deaths on roads.
Initially, this sounds like a really positive idea. Who's supportive of it?
Sure. So road safety groups support this measure as a way to reduce deaths and those concerned who, or I guess had people who've been in car accidents.
But on the flip side, some groups have concerns. What have you heard?
Yeah, so particularly here in the Far West, which is a rural and remote area in the Far West of New South Wales, we have groups like the Pastoralist Association of West Darling concerned about road funding for these roads if the speed limit is reduced. Sam Bevan is the president.
If they reduce the speed limit, we'd be a little bit worried that it might be an excuse to lower the budget, lower the already tight budget for maintaining and upgrading the roads around here. They might be more inclined to say, oh, well, the speed limit's lower now, so there's no need to seal that dirt road, or there's no need to make a few little roads wider or fix that causeway or whatever the case may be.
You know, he's also worried about the potential impact on trucking livestock. Now, here in the Far West, there's a lot of pastoralists who produce and transport sheep and goats and sometimes cattle as well. And abattoirs are already a long way away from our region. Our closest abattoir is Mildura, a 3-hour drive away. We've got abattoirs in Melbourne, a 900-kilometre drive away, and Bourke, Gundagai. These places are few and far between. So to travel these distances is a long way. And if the government was to reduce the speed limit, that's going to take a lot longer for livestock to be transported to abattoirs.
I mean, we're already a long way from all of our sale yards, abattoirs, processes and what have you. And there's a curfew on most of these places if we suddenly, and we're already tight on the curfew, a lot of the trucks are already turning up there quite late. Yeah, we'd have to be loading at a different time, or even the trucks might have to travel with two people driving just so that they don't run out of driving hours, because if they run out of their work hours, they have to stop for 6 or 7 hours, and that's just an animal welfare issue in itself, the longer travel times there. And if they end up driving two up in the truck, then freight gets more expensive, and you know, freight companies might not be able to find two people at a time to drive in the truck. It just make transporting livestock incredibly difficult.
Sam Bevan, the president of the Pastoralists Association of West Darling, speaking there. Catherine, I understand there are also some concerns around the social impact of reducing speed limits. What are those?
Yeah, so a lot of pastoralists have children who attend school of the year, and they often have what they call town weeks or mini school where they often travel in. And so Sam said that, you know, he's concerned that people might actually think twice about going to these events if the speed limit is lowered because of that extra travel time.
With school of the year, going to mini schools or going to town weeks, if suddenly a 2-hour trip became a 2-hour and 45 minute trip or a 3-hour trip, it would make it sort of, people would be less inclined to go, even on the social side of things as well.
Catherine, did Sam respond at all around questions over whether this could actually, though, see a reduction in fatalities on regional and rural roads?
I think he was very cautious about it having actual impact. He said that people are going to speed if you still reduce the speed limit. So he was cautious about it having any marginal, you know, improvement.
So what happens next?
So public consultation on this proposal closes on November 25th. The Federal Regional Development Minister, Kirsty McMain, who is responsible for road safety, has told the ABC there were no speed limits on unsealed roads and encouraged interested stakeholders to engage in the consultation process. She said the government has doubled funding for the Roads to Recovery program to $1 billion and would remain at high levels in future budgets.
Thanks so much, Catherine.
Thanks, Alex.
Broken Hill reporter there, Catherine Spackman.
All around the country, you're on ABC Australia Wide.
I eat corn sometimes and my mum cooks it in the oven.
Well, Charles, how much rain did we have? He said, no, none. I said, you're mad, man.
ABC Australia Wide.
Because I came from Wynyard area where it rains and rains and rains. And when it's not raining, it's raining more.
On ABC Radio.
And finally, it is October the 31st, which means it's Halloween. And tonight you might see some ghosts and monsters on the streets of your town. But at one of the few iris nurseries in regional Victoria, black flowers are in bloom. Reporter Annie Brown went to take a look.
A flower farm in springtime is not exactly a spooky place to be. But this time of year, at Springview Irises in Ebden, Victoria, a near black bearded iris variety is in bloom. Katie O'Grady explains.
So black suited, it's by far the darkest variety that we grow, and I've never seen such a dark flower in local nurseries or just in general. It's near black, and when it comes out to bloom, it's usually around Halloween, which I find really cool. And people are just drawn to it just because it's so unique. And we grow about half a row of that particular variety. And when that half row is blooming, it's just a really unique feature that people have never really seen before, because it just is near black. It's that very, very dark purple. So it's, you know, draws a lot of attention.
So I didn't know this until you told me, but yeah, you can't get a pure black flower, can you?
No, so there's no true blacks in terms of flowers, but they certainly get very close. They are very, very dark purple, but this one by far is the darkest I've ever seen.
It's beautiful, yeah.
It is.
What can you tell us about, I guess, irises and bearded irises in particular for, I guess, the uninitiated?
Okay, so bearded iris are extremely tough, and we don't have town water here, so we had to pick a flower that I loved that was going to be hardy. So they can survive prolonged dry periods for months, and they withstand the dry conditions really well. They also love frosts. So they're that real ideal plant that love the heat and they love the cold temperatures, which it is hard to find a plant that likes both of those. They're very, very tough. They multiply very fast as well. And we've only ever started with one rhizome of each variety, and in a year or two you might have 10 growing from that same plant. So they're very tough, they grow very quick, and they're a plant that keeps on giving.
How would you describe what a bearded iris looks like?
Okay, I would describe a bearded iris as looking like a French can-can dancer. So particularly on this sort of angle, we can see that these are the standards and the falls. The falls look like they're ruffled skirts. So they're very delicate petals. Some of them have a beautiful shine on them. And to me, they just look like a beautiful little can-can dancer wearing her skirt. So
when most people picture an iris, they think purple. But did you know the flower is actually named after the Greek goddess of the rainbow?
I got into bearded irises in 2018. I fell in love with them the minute that I saw them. And they come in such a beautiful rainbow of colours that I just knew that I had to grow them. We grow 800 different varieties of bearded irises. So there's, yeah, certainly a lot of colours that we have on offer, and some of them have broken colours, some of them have veining on them, there's bicolour, there's bitone, and yeah, I think people are not aware of the different variety and colours that bearded iris do come in. They often think of the whites, the yellows and the purples, but there's just such a broad spectrum of colour with them.
Katie runs one of the few bearded iris farms around the country.
I would say there's probably, you know, probably less than a dozen in Australia now, which is why, you know, our farm is trying to spread the awareness of bearded iris. People do think of the purples, the yellows and the whites, the heritage varieties, but you're not often seeing the more modern varieties that we grow in local nurseries, so there's not that awareness of them. So certainly it's not a common flower that is grown throughout Australia. I'd say, yeah, definitely less than a dozen flower farms, which makes us quite unique. Like, we just have so many repeat clients coming back to the bearded irises. Once they've started with one or two, they see their beauty, and because they're so easy to grow, they love the full sun. They, you know, they're not a lot of work. Like, perhaps dahlias might be more involved. They're just, the iris virus starts really quick with them. So But I always say out there that there's, you know, worse addictions out there. So if I can just buy a few more flowers, then that's okay. Yeah.
The iris virus.
The iris virus.
Katie O'Grady from Springview Irises in Ebden, Victoria, speaking to reporter Annie Brown. And that's Australia Wide for this week. My name's Alex Barwick. A big thanks to the program's producer, Alex Hyman, and thanks for your company. Remember, you can podcast the show or listen back to the program through the ABC Listen app or by visiting the Australia Wide website. Just search for ABC Australia Wide. And you can always email us. We love to hear what's happening in your part of Australia. australiawide.radio@abc.net.au. Have a lovely weekend.
ABC Listen.